How Near Is the End by Robert C. Newman. Brief abstract. There are many out there ready to set dates for the second coming of Christ. There are others who think he will never return, or at least not visibly, or for hundreds of years. Does the Bible give us any information on this question? Here we attempt some sort of answer. Well, the question of how near is the end and how it might come is not something that's only concerned Christians or even people in other religions. Some secular scientists have even been concerned about that. I think of Isaac Asimov's book, A Choice of Catastrophes, in which we have some scientific musings on how the world might end. They list the various kinds of disasters that might happen. And there's plenty of turmoil around today that might lead to some disasters of world scope. There's the Middle East unrest and terrorism. There's AIDS and some other diseases, like Ebola. There's global warming and the fear of famine or being submerged in a rising ocean. A number of Christians have gone, particularly in the last century or two, with a 6,000-year theory of human history, in which Adam was viewed as being around 4,000 B.C., and Abraham's time around 2,000 B.C., Jesus at the turn of the era, we might say 0 B.C., 0 A.D., etc., and the second coming at 2,000 A.D., and so there was some excitement as we came up to 2,000 here some years ago. But obviously, the second coming didn't happen in 2,000 A.D. Some are now revising that some. Some have suggested around 2,030 A.D., that is 2,000 years after Jesus' death and resurrection. So, how near is the end? And one of the questions we want to ask here is, can we tell? And we're going to suggest, no, not exactly, and look at three passages, Matthew 24, 42 to 44, Matthew 24, 36, 1 Thessalonians 5, 1 through 3. Let's have a look at those. In Matthew 24, 42 to 44, Jesus says, "Therefore keep watch, because you do not know on what day your Lord will come. But understand this, if the owner of the house had known at what time of night the thief was coming, he would have kept watch, would not have let his house be broken into. So you also must be ready, because the Son of Man comes in an hour when you do not expect him." A little earlier in the same chapter, Jesus says, 24:36, "No one knows about that day or hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father." It's one of the passages that hint to us that Jesus set aside use of his divine knowledge during what we might call the humiliation part of his incarnation, that time from the conception to probably the resurrection or the ascension. But the point, at least at that time in history, only the Father knew the time of the second coming. Paul in 1 Thessalonians 5, verses 1 through 3, says, "Now, brothers, about times and dates, we do not really need to write to you, for you know very well that the day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night. While people are saying peace and safety, destruction will come on them suddenly, as labor pains on a pregnant woman, and they will not escape." So, can we tell? Not exactly. Matthew 24, 42-44, "Be on the alert. We don't know when. It will be when you don't expect it." Matthew 24, 36, "No one but the Father knows the day nor the hour." 1 Thessalonians 5, 1-3, "The day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night." So, can we tell? Well, not exactly, but we should be able to recognize its approach. In Matthew 24, 32-35, Jesus gives the parable of the fig tree, and in 1 Thessalonians 5, 1-6, Paul has something to say on the subject as well. So let's take a look at both of those, recognizing its approach. 1 Thessalonians 4, 5, and 6, "But you, brothers, are not in darkness, so that this day should surprise you like a thief. You are all sons of light and sons of the day. We do not belong to the night or the darkness. So then let us not be like others who are asleep, but let us be alert and self-controlled." And Jesus in Matthew 24, 32-35. "Now learn this lesson from the fig tree," he says. "As soon as its twigs get tender and its leaves come out, you know that summer is near. Even so, when you see all these things, you know that it is near, right at the door," second coming, or maybe he is near, Jesus. "I tell you the truth, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. So can we tell? Well, we should be able to recognize its approach. Matthew 24, 32-35 gives this parable of the fig tree. This has been misused to calculate the year. So Aho Lindsay got this started, but it was picked up and carried by a lot of others. He suggested that the budding of the fig tree, that the fig tree represented Israel in an allegory, and the budding of the fig tree represented signs of life, and so that was the reestablishment of Israel as a nation in 1948, and that this generation not passing away meant it had to, the second coming had to be within a generation from 1948. He calculated a generation would be 40 years, and you get 1988. However, if you actually look at the passage carefully, particularly its parallel in Luke, look at the learn a lesson from the fig tree and all the trees, you see that the real meaning is an analogy that just as when a fig tree begins to bud, you know that summer is near. So when these signs occur, and he's going to list a bunch of signs in that passage, know that the second coming is near. The 1 Thessalonians 5, 1-6 passage says, though it comes like a thief, it shouldn't surprise the believer, since the believer is not in the dark, and that we should stay awake. Well, it shouldn't surprise the believer in one sense, because the believer believes that Jesus exists, that Jesus rose from the dead, that Jesus is who he claims to be, that Jesus can predict the future, that Jesus is returning. Whereas there are certainly many unbelievers who do not believe those things about Jesus, and so they will certainly be surprised in regard to the second coming. Well, Jesus indicates that, and elsewhere in Scripture indicates, that there will be signs of the end. And that's the point of the parable of the fig tree. We want to look at Jesus' message on the Mount of Olives in Matthew 24. Paul's predictions of moral collapse in the man of lawlessness in 2 Timothy 3, 1-5, and 2 Thessalonians 2, 1-12. And John's vision of world government and world religion in Revelation chapter 13. So let's have a look at those. Jesus, Matthew 24, 3-6, where he speaks of false Christs and wars. As Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately. Tell us, they said, when will this happen, and what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? Jesus answered, watch out that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, claiming, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. You will hear wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you're not alarmed. These things must but happen, but the end is still to come. Then Jesus goes on in verses 7 and 8. Nation will rise against nation, he says, kingdom against kingdom. There'll be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of birth pangs. So he brings up this analogy of birth pangs. Jesus goes on in that chapter to talk of persecution and various other events. In verse 9 of persecution, in verse 9 of general hatred of Christians, verse 10 of betrayal, verse 11 of false prophets, verse 12 of increased lawlessness, verse 12 of love growing cold, and verse 14 of the gospel proclaimed to all nations. Then Jesus goes on to talk about the great tribulation. He says that this will start with what he calls the abomination of desolation, Matthew 24:15, and refers to the prophet Daniel. And Daniel uses that phrase, abomination of desolation, in Daniel 9, 27, 11, 31, and 12, 11. He warns his hearers that when that happens, in verse 16, 17, they should get away quickly. And in verses 18 through 22, that nothing will match this great tribulation anywhere else in human history. He says in verses 23 to 25, there'll be continued appearance of false Christs and false prophets, even under these circumstances, but that Jesus' return will be unmistakable, verses 26 and 27. Jesus then says something about his second coming, still in Matthew 24. Immediately after this tribulation, says Jesus, Matthew 24, 29, There will be signs in the heaven, verses 29 to 30. Jesus' return will be visible, verse 30. The nations will see it and mourn, verse 30. Jesus will send his angels to gather his people, verse 31. So that's a quick tour of Jesus' so-called Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24 that sketches some signs that will precede the end. Paul, in 2 Timothy 3, 1 through 5, speaks of moral collapse. He says, "There will be terrible times in the last days. People will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boastful, proud, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, without love, unforgiving, slanderous, without self-control, brutal, not lovers of the good, treacherous, rash, conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power." In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, 1 through 12, Paul speaks of the man of lawlessness. He says, "That day will not come," second coming, "until the rebellion occurs and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the man doomed to destruction. He will oppose and exalt himself over everything that is called God or is worshipped. So he sets himself up in God's temple, proclaiming himself to be God." "The coming of this lawless one will be in accordance with the work of Satan, displayed in all kinds of counterfeit miracles, signs, and wonders, and in every sort of evil that deceives those who are perishing." The Apostle John, over in Revelation chapter 13, speaks of a coming world government, speaks of it in a rather allegorical way. He says, it's a vision, you remember, "I saw a beast coming out of the sea. He had 10 horns and 7 heads. The dragon," who's been identified earlier as the allegorical picture of Satan, "gave the beast his power and throne and great authority. The whole world was astonished and followed the beast. Men worshipped the beast because he had given worshipped the dragon because he had given authority to the beast. And they also worshipped the beast and asked, 'Who is like the beast? Who can make war against him?'" In the same passage, Revelation 13, 11 through 17, we see a prediction of some kind of world religion. "Then I saw another beast coming out of the earth. He had 2 horns like a lamb, but he spoke like a dragon. He exercised all the authority of the first beast on his behalf and made the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast. He performed great and miraculous signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven. He deceived the inhabitants of the earth." So, if we try and pull together the signs of the end that we've seen in these passages, Jesus' message on the Mount of Olives in Matthew 24 gives us a rather substantial list. Paul's predictions of moral collapse and the man of lawlessness in 2 Timothy 3 and 1 Thessalonians 2 give a list of characteristics of people as a result of this moral collapse, and then gives us a sketch of this man of lawlessness. And then in Revelation 13, John gives us a vision of a world government and world religion that looks like a nightmare to what many people are hoping to come from world government and world religion. Well, with this whole list of signs in front of us, the question we might ask ourselves is, where are we now? Well, there's no sign of the Antichrist yet, but we do have a great growth of technology in recent years. Technology has given us a situation now in which humans face an unprecedented situation in regard to speed of communication, making one world government more feasible, but also speeding up the spread of the gospel. Obviously, at the moment, this speed of communication is very chaotic in some sense with the internet, and any Antichrist would have to make some stab at trying to tame that in some way or another. We see not only technology, but we see scientism, what we might call evolutionism or naturalism. That is a view of reality that essentially undermines all traditional religions by saying, really, there is no God, and many of them saying there's nothing beyond matter, energy, etc. And it thereby undermines all concept of moral absolutes. Clint, I think, fits what we see then in Paul's remark about moral collapse. So, there's technology, There's scientism. There's what we might call ecumenism. The term is not floating around quite as much now as it was a generation ago. It's now broadened from a desire to unite all varieties of Christianity into one group, but the desire to reunite all religions. And part of the reasoning for this is to avoid conflict, to move in the direction of political correctness of some sort. And of course, that's assisted by the loss of absolutes. And there's Israel. The regathering of Israel since 1948 has produced the Middle East tensions and generated what certainly appears to be irreconcilable conflict. That has led in many ways to the rise of terrorism. Besides these four items, we also should add disasters. Where are we now in regard to disasters? Not much yet. Some famines, the usual earthquakes, but as population grows, both famines and earthquakes become more serious problems. There's certainly some warranted fear of AIDS and Ebola and other diseases. Science News some years ago had a feature article on the danger of epidemics that has developed over recent years, if you like. Warfare became truly chilling in the 20th century with very brief nuclear war, but plenty of equipment to have it, and a little bit of biological and chemical warfare, but certainly some of that material around, or at least the technology for it, is around very much. Also, the concern about global warming is growing rather rapidly. So, where are we now? Well, that's where we are now. What should we do about it? Well, how near is the end? I don't know. It might be close. There are lots of things I expect to see that I haven't seen yet, but it still might be close. In any case, switching from the end viewed on a world's level to the end viewed on a personal level, in any case, our personal end may be close. That for any of us could happen any minute. What should we do about it? We should repent. What does repent mean? Does that mean doing some actions that are required by a priest or other religious figure? Now, the biblical term means to turn or change one's direction, and it basically has the idea of abandoning one's lifestyle of ignoring God and turn to God. We need to trust in Jesus. As we understand Christianity better and better, we get to see that Jesus is God's provision to supply what humans cannot themselves supply because we're not capable of it anymore. Jesus comes and lives a lifestyle of complete obedience to God, loving God with all his heart and mind and soul and strength, loving his neighbors and self, and we never do. And Jesus, being both man, a human, and God, was able to suffer in a few hours on the cross what would take us forever to suffer. So that when we trust in Jesus, his righteousness, which we owe God, is accounted as though it were our righteousness. And when we trust in Jesus, the punishment that we deserve was taken by him. We need to trust in Jesus. And we need to live like each day is important. That we do live in a world in which there's a good God, in which God is writing a story, we might say, in which there's a possibility for us to be significant positive characters or significant negative characters. And we need to live like each day is important. Well, that's the end of our talk. The end is not yet, but we have reason to believe, from the fact that Christianity has given good evidence that it is true, and from the signs which the Bible has given, that the end is getting closer. May we prepare ourselves to be ready for the end.